From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this summer at an early childhood program in Weymouth, Massachusetts. The program is called South Shores Stars, and they were searching for preschool teachers to fill a number of positions. There were zero applicants. The director, Jennifer Curtis, said this was a big change. When she was a superintendent of a local school district, she'd typically see 200 applicants for open jobs there. So what's the issue here? Well, daycare workers generally make around $12 an hour. They work year-round in demanding jobs where there aren't often good benefits. Curtis shared her program situation with the Washington Post, which reported that the child care industry is down 126,700 positions nationwide. Workers are leaving for higher-paying jobs as bank tellers, administrative assistants, or retail clerks. The situation has been an issue for a number of years, but during the pandemic, it has risen to a crisis level. With fewer childcare workers, fewer children can be enrolled in daycare programs. Their parents or caregivers might need to stay home with them, leading to those adults, usually women, leaving the workforce. The Post reports that nearly 1.6 million mothers of children under the age of 17 are still missing from the labor force, and that has ripple effects on the economy. The staffing crisis is impacting the Rochester region, too, and we discuss it with our guest this hour. Bridget Shumway is the president of Generations Child Care. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
On the line with us is Pete Nabosny. Pete is the director of policy for the Children's Agenda. Pete, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Evan.
Rosa Marie Curtis is president of Marvelous Mind Academy. Rosa Marie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Peer is the executive director of the Child Care Council. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan, for having me today.
All right, Bridget and I were talking before this program began, and you said that really this crisis has become more acute since when? What's the timeline?
Well, I think about 5 or 6 months ago when people started going back to the office or being called back to work, and the demand was there, but the staffing wasn't there. So the candidates weren't there for us, particularly with our entry-level staff.
What is it like for you now? Paint the picture for us.
I've been doing this for 27 years, Evan, and it is more challenging than it's ever been. I think there's a number of factors. We all talk about wages, and when we talk about wages, we need to talk about how childcare is paid for, what their budgets look like. I think that for some, there's a fear of working in a care setting right now. I also think, and we don't give enough credit, child care made it possible for every other essential worker to go to work. But it's a very demanding job. And quite honestly, some of the other positions you just mentioned are not as demanding.
So you make an important point about how these positions are funded and, you know, perhaps how that's changed or not changed, maybe where we can go from here, which we'll cover. I want to read a little bit more from the Washington Post reporting on what it calls a broken market. And they're quoting Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Quote, child care is a textbook example of a broken market, Yellen said, a mother herself. She pointed out that families pay, on average, 13% of their income on child care for young kids, yet daycare workers earn so little they rank in the bottom 2% of all professions. President Biden has proposed the largest federal investment ever in child care in an effort to transform the sector. More than a third of child care providers are now considering quitting or closing down their business within the next year as a sense of hopelessness permeates the industry. That's according to a report last month from the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Over half of minority-owned centers are in danger of shutting down, the report warns. Centers that serve working-class families or those in rural areas are especially in danger of closing, as directors say they cannot raise costs. For years, there have been calls to pay child care workers more, as the median pay in the industry, $25,460 a year, according to the Labor Department, is below the poverty line for a family of four. During the pandemic, the work has become even harder, as staff must ensure kids as young as 2 or 3 wear masks and don't touch each other. End quote. Have you thought about shutting down over this, Bridget?
I have not, honestly. I don't know how we keep it together some days. We just have wonderful people who work in this field. We kept it together throughout the whole virus, and it's never been a question for us.
Do you know people in your industry who are thinking of that?
I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be a devastating choice to make, and very difficult situation for people like Rosemarie Curtis, president of the Marvelous Mind Academy. Rosemarie, tell us about the work that you're doing there.
I'd love to, Evan. The work that we're doing at Marvelous Mind Academy is very timely for this pandemic. At the wake of the pandemic, we had just secured a lease with Stern Properties in Village Gate, and with intentions of opening Easter Sunday. Well, everyone knows that COVID happened in March here in Rochester, so that didn't happen. And what we had to do, we had to pivot. And really, we were pivoting back to how we started, which was as a pop-up daycare center. And we hosted childcare at a local business for essential workers. So just continuing to be innovative and thinking outside of the box, outside of traditional childcare, we were able to stay relevant. We were able to stay open and serve from our mission, which is to help parents and their young learners make great strides toward their goals. Now we are fully operational within Village Gate as a drop-in daycare center for families who need part-time care. This is where we help them bridge the gap in their child care solution. So if a family is working, mom may work, you know, 9 to 5, and dad has an evening shift that is, you know, 5 to 9, but somebody's got to be there for that child when they get off the bus. So we help to fill those kinds of gaps for families who don't particularly need full-time care. They just need to fill those gaps.
What happens next for you now? You know, paint the picture going forward here. Bridget Shumway says she's not going to shut down. Generations is going to try to find a way to keep doing this, but many other colleagues are facing a difficult choice. What about you, Rosemarie?
Because of the innovative nature of our program called Bridge Care, we're actually seeing an increase in parents who are enrolling with us because of the change in times. So yes, there are a lot of families who are not going back to work. There are a lot of families who have decided they want to take on the entrepreneurial journey, and they happen to find us to be the best fit because of the flexibility in scheduling, because of our long hours. We're open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. So it's really a pivoting of the industry that's happening here at Marvelous Minds. Mm. So no, we have no intentions of closing either.
Let me get Jeff and Pete. Jeff Peer, Executive Director of the Child Care Council. What are you seeing?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of the same things that we just talked about. We talk to a lot of different providers at all modalities, everything from family to group family and to the larger centers, just like Bridget's. And they're all struggling for capacity and for staffing. And like Bridget said, it's great to see that providers like herself are going to fight through this and stay open, but a lot of them are struggling, especially in our rural areas. We have to remember that some of these providers serve a large area and they're the only provider. So we are hearing from some of these rural counties that they are thinking about closing. They do not have the staffing. They're going through a difficult time. They just went through all the COVID. And if we lose some of those programs in those areas, that's going to leave a big void for providers and families in that area, which will cause a child care desert in that area as well. So we are concerned. We are hearing that. And any meeting I attend, that's the number one thing that comes up is staffing.
Well, and Pete Nabosny, this is a classic example of a ripple effect situation where if you see things come to pass the way that Jeff is describing and the way we are, frankly, already seeing in some places with child care, and then parents have to make hard choices. Typically, women, we're already seeing women leaving the labor force at some of the highest rates in a generation or more. And, you know, the tentacle effects of this go far and wide here, but what's top of mind for you as you sort of survey this problem?
Well, there's a lot there, you know, and I'll confess I'm, you know, I'm experiencing this myself. You know, we've had some real challenges this summer and fall with childcare, with, you know, our children had been attending it, you know, through, you know, after a few months into the pandemic, but there are, you know, challenges of childcare is a highly regulated, appropriately so, industry. And, you know, the childcare provider has to have staff in the room to meet ratios and to ensure that kids are safe and well cared for. And if they don't have the staff, they can't operate. And so we've had days where we've had to, you know, pick up our kids early. My daughter, who's in pre-K now, doesn't have after school care, which is typically offered, because there's, you know, not the staff there. So there's a lot of juggling that my wife and I have to do to manage this. And we're, you know, partnering with other families and figuring it out. And, you know, thankfully I myself have, a job that has some flexibility. And my job is to understand what's happening in the childcare, industry, among other things. And so I have an employer who's attuned to this as well. But, you know, there's a lot of other parents of young children who are really struggling, and having to, you know, think through some of these decisions, like you're talking about, of leaving the workforce or reducing hours or, you know, finding some other way to ensure that their kids are cared for. And that's a lot of stress for families. And so to tie it back to these larger concerns, I think, you know, child care workers are incredibly essential to our entire economy operating, but they're also essential to children, you know, developing and thriving and having, you know, safe learning environments and being well cared for. And the absence of childcare is a real family stress, right? And so, you know, you worry that this is not just contributing to, you know, economic loss, but it's contributing to, you know, familial strain, which, mm-hmm. you know, harms kids. So it's a grim picture out there in terms of, you know, what's happening. And, you know, I'm sure we'll pivot to some ideas about what we can do about it, but it's a tricky problem that's part of a much larger, you know, workforce issue and just overall societal prioritization of typically women's work.
Well, and so diagnosing why we got here, there's something that I think is unquantifiable, and that is the number of workers in any sector right now who are still not willing or reticent to go back because of COVID. Those numbers have obviously shrunk with vaccination availability, but it's not nothing. And this is exactly what came up when we talked about the shortages in restaurant workers and retail workers. You know, we heard from a number of listeners who say, you know, for example, that they're vaccinated, but maybe they've got young kids or immunocompromised kids. You know, maybe they're caregiving for parents who are immunocompromised, and they're not willing to go back to, for example, a restaurant. So that's going to be some of what is driving this situation in childcare. But it's certainly not all of it. This is not a problem, as Bridget Shumway was saying, that is brand new. It's just been exacerbated by this pandemic, and now it is becoming a crisis. But it is not all driven by that. And so, Pete, for you, is there a singular place that your gaze falls when you first think about what is driving this? Or I hesitate to use the word blame, but how do you see that?
Well, so for a little context, so I looked up, you know, prior to this discussion, the sort of the New York State data. You referenced some of the national data, and employment in New York is still down about 8% overall from pre-pandemic levels. In the childcare system, it's down 16%. So we've got, you know, double the number of vacancies in childcare. It's about 10,000, almost 11,000 fewer workers in New York State than there were at the same time 2 years ago. So that's a lot. That's just to be able to kind of quantify. I think a lot of this ultimately does come down to, you know, as Bridget mentioned, you know, some of the challenging aspects of the work, but largely the wages that we're paying. I mean, this is incredibly important work. It's so essential for positive child development, and it's among the lowest paying jobs in our community. And that's not to blame the employers for it, because they have to make really difficult decisions about what to set, you know, what they can charge, because for the most part, it's coming out of the pockets of those families. We don't have a, you know, a federally or state fully funded childcare system. And so, you know, a childcare provider has to do some tough math of, well, what can I afford to pay my workers? What can I afford to charge my families so they can continue to come to care here? And as you mentioned, you know, we're well above the sort of recommended share of your income that's going towards childcare. And so the economics of it don't work. And ultimately, it comes down to the fact that in this country, unlike a lot of other countries, we primarily leave the cost of affording care on those parents entirely. Now, we have exceptions for lower income families, which is good, and we need to expand that. But the biggest payer of childcare in this community is you know, parents and families, and they are constrained in what they can afford to shell out every week or month.
And so on that subject, let me start with Bridget, but ask the other guests on what workers are paid and how, you know, maybe parents are thinking about this, because, you know, Pete's right, they already have their own constraints. And any parent, especially new parents who are always blown away at the cost of daycare or childcare, it can be really hard to sort of get your head around the idea that daycare or childcare can cost this much, and yet workers aren't making that much money. And I talked to a parent not that long ago who said, I want workers who care for my children to be paid more because I want them to be maximally invested in the work they're doing. That's not to say that workers who aren't paid what they should get paid aren't invested. I mean, there's great people working in this industry. But the sentiment expressed by this parent was, I want them to be paid more. I want them to be maximally invested when they're caring for my child. And these centers should just pay them more. Pay them more. So let's start with that, Bridget.
Sure.
They said, just pay them more.
I would love to. So I think it's important to recognize that there are different ways in which childcare providers fill their budget out, you know, where their revenue comes from. If you're a provider in a high income area community, you probably have all private pay families. You may have some leverage for changing your tuition rates to increase the wages of your staff. If you're a provider, and there are many of them in the city of Rochester who are relying on subsidies for the tuition payments, their hands are very tied. And if I could change a couple things that would allow providers to know consistently, reliably, you know, what they could plan for a wage increase, it would be to fix the subsidies system. So right now, we pay providers based on the number of hours of care a child is with them. If a child's with us 30 hours, we get full reimbursement. Every time I get an authorization for 29.5 hours, I want to scream because I'm not being paid for that full slot.
How often does that happen?
Too often. Not as much as people might think, but even a little bit is just exasperating. And remember, if that child is ill for a couple of days, we don't get a full reimbursement. You know, a landlord still gets their rent if a tenant is out of town for a couple of days. It's a broken system in that regard. Second thing with subsidy, and I've said it on this program before, the state changes those market rates only like every 3 years now. They changed them in 2016, 2019. If providers cannot plan for what their revenue is going to be, they can't plan to increase the wages of their workers. We have to fix the subsidy system. That would be my number one priority. I could go on with a lot of other ways, but that's number one, especially for the providers in the city of Rochester who have taken on the mission of serving our low-income families.
Who has the most immediate power to fix that then?
I think New York State does.
That's a state issue too.
I think that Monroe County has done a great job recently, especially through the pandemic, of assisting child care providers, no question. But the market rate thing drives me crazy. You know, it used to be that the rates were set so parents could have access to 75% of providers. Then it got lowered to 69 or 68. And then we went from every 2 years, Evan, I knew I was going to get a rate adjustment. It might be 2%, it might be 4%, but I knew I was going to get it. Now it's every like 3 years. And, you know, providers can't plan to give increases to their staff when they have no idea what they're going to get in those market rates. And, you know, of course, the whole New York State, and I don't disagree with it, the ratios make the, like Janet Yellen said, the financial model can be very difficult.
So to you, it's still primarily a state-driven issue. Let me also get your take on how the Washington Post has been reporting on what the federal government is talking about doing. So this is from the Post piece, quote, lawmakers in Washington approved $39 billion in child care relief in March as part of the American Rescue Plan, with the bulk of the money going towards stabilization funds that child care centers can use for anything from worker pay to fixing the roof to buying masks.
Months later, only 14 states had their applications up and running so child care centers can apply for funding, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The funding is viewed as a short-term fix by economists and daycare owners who say it would not be enough to permanently raise pay in the industry. President Biden and top Democrats in Congress want to spend about $450 billion on child care as part of the sweeping $3.5 trillion bill, which would be the largest ever investment in federally backed child care programs. The legislation would reduce child care costs for low and middle income families and offer higher wages for caregivers while providing free pre-K to all 3 and 4 year olds. Republicans and some moderate Democrats, such as Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, are balking at the high price of the overall bill. They want to see a smaller package where aid is more targeted to the neediest. Manchin said it's not the federal government's responsibility to educate all of our children in May. End quote. Okay, so you've got what looks like maybe a temporary help, but maybe not a structural change, and then a much bigger and more ambitious plan from the federal government that is tied up in politics. We don't know if that's going to where that will go. Do you see that as a potential lifeline here?
So I won't get started on Senator Manchin.
Oh, you can get started. You may start right now.
But I will give credit to New York State for this. They did come out with their stabilization grants. Generations applied immediately. We were approved for those. I think it's great. It is allowing us, in terms of recruiting and retaining some of our staff, to have some resources to do that. So I think that that's wonderful. It also has provided some funds for taking care of some health and safety issues, maybe, that you'll have to pay for later. And so if you can pay for those items now, you have more money to pay your staff, correct? But it's not a long-term solution because it's a one-time shot of money and then it goes away. Mm-hmm. So you simply can't say, well, I'm going to increase my lead teachers by 15% because, A, again, no increase in market rates. So when this money's gone, where's the money going to come from?
Okay. And that's even with the larger bill, you think? Even if that could pass?
No, I like the larger bill.
Okay, so the larger bill could be a structural
thing. I think it could really be very helpful. I know Pete is more into the details of that than I am, but as I've read it, the ability to subsidize more families, put money in their pocket to pay for higher quality care allows those providers to also pay their staff more.
That just becomes a question of whether it can pass in the current political
yes,
climate,
of course.
Which is why you're holding your tongue on Joe Manchin.
Yes.
I see. I'll ask all of our other guests about that. But Pete, she invoked your name here. Do you want to weigh in on how you see the federal efforts?
Sure, yeah. So the federal package that's been proposed that's kind of moving its way through the House right now would essentially cover all low and middle income and even upper middle income families that have young children. So it wouldn't cover school age children for after school care. It would cover children, you know, birth to school entry, basically. And in New York State, the current version of the House, which, you know, could change, would cap the costs for a family of four making up to $200,000 a year. So it really would grab the vast majority of households and say, you know, at that upper income level, you're paying about 7% of your income towards child care. And that structure would allow for wages to rise, right? For New York State to, I agree with everything Bridget said about the market rate and how the state has kind of been stretching that out and making it more difficult for providers to give regular salary increases and everything else. This bill would give New York the flexibility to kind of come up with a different, structure for how it determines rates for subsidized children, because so many more families would be under the kind of subsidy umbrella, including some, you know, some real middle class and upper middle class families. So it would do a lot to address the problems. I've got my own little quibbles with some of the things in the edges, but in general, it's night and day. It's a complete difference from how our current system is structured. And last point on it, the current system, part of what frustrates providers and frustrates families is that the current model is it's a block grant from the federal government to the state. So the federal government gives the state a certain amount of money, it requires the state kicks in a certain amount of money, and then we kind of have to figure out how many families we can enroll with that, what we can set rates at, who's eligible, college students with kids, are they eligible? Is someone in a job training program, you know, et cetera? The state and counties have to kind of make these decisions, and so they leave certain people out so they can support others. This would replace that. This would say that this is a, you know, it's an entitlement program for families making below the threat level. So it'd be much more like, you know, SNAP, you know, food stamps. You don't go to the county and apply and they say, well, we ran out of food stamp money this month, come back again in the future. But that has happened with childcare in this county in the past. And so it's a significant change that would provide a lot of, you know, economic security for families and for the childcare sector and workforce.
Pete, how do you feel about Senator Manchin's contention that it's still too broad, that it really, this kind of federal help should be targeted to the most needy, and this goes too far?
Well, you know, you and I have spoken about this many times. I agree that we should be targeting help to the most needy, and we need to be, you know, thinking through these things in terms of scarce resources when they are truly scarce, that we need to set priorities. But we set ourselves up in this country oftentimes for failure when we try to, you know, too carefully target, you know, assistance for only certain types of households and only certain types of families in certain situations. And a lot of those families who might be eligible end up falling through the cracks. So one point is our obsession with means testing and targeting actually excludes a lot of people that we purport to intend to target. And then second, you know, a family making, you know, $90,000 a year with two young children, you know, they could be paying in this community with, you know, $25,000 a year. That's unaffordable for that family. And so the cost of childcare pushes a lot of you know, middle-income families to a breaking point, or forces, again, particularly moms to leave the workforce when they have young children. And that's, you know, that's an issue for our economy and everything else. So if Senator Manchin, you know, he may not think it's the government's responsibility to educate every child, but if we want to see, you know, positive growth in our economy, if we want, you know, children to thrive, if, you know, if we want all these things that I think most people agree are important, we need to recognize that the current structure, the lack of a system in a lot of ways, has a lot of negative consequences for families, you know, up and down the income scale.
Yeah, and just briefly, Bridget Chumway, I won't ask you personally about Senator Manchin, but can you weigh in on what Pete just weighed in on? Would this be helping targeting too many families?
Oh, absolutely not. And he is so on target about the family that makes 90 to even 100,000. And his $25,000 number is actually conservative. You know, infant care is over $15,000 now. So, I mean, I have a family with two infants who applied yesterday. I mean, they're looking at $30,000.
Mm. Rosemarie Curtis, what do you see as sort of, you know, maybe from the state and then from that federal level, the kinds of things that are either happening or being proposed that could impact what you're trying to do at Marvelous Mind Academy?
Well, I can tell you that the stabilization grant that came through Marvelous Mind Academy did not qualify for it. And I will resonate with Bridget Shumway when we talk about, you know, whether or not the new aid that they're proposing should be focused and centralized. I disagree. I think it should be broad. And I just wanted to also comment on the staffing challenges and increasing that. What we do at Marvelous Minds is we operate on interns and volunteers. Like, we have partnership after partnership after partnership because we know how challenging it is to keep a living wage going strong in our industry. So then we pivoted and said, hey, listen, we have got to figure out a way that we can get people back to work, get them trained, and then we'll be able to qualify them. And it's just a working system. It's a, what do you call that, when it's reciprocity, you know, where our interns have a sense of belonging, they have a sense of care and support. That then transfers to children, it transfers to families, and then eventually it'll transfer to the rest of their lives is the goal. So as far as, you know, what the state is doing and what the federal is doing, I think that it's been, you know, phenomenal for organizations who are operating from a traditional lens of childcare, but it doesn't help us who are the innovators of what we will be seeing in the future of childcare.
All right, and let's ask Jeff Peer to elaborate on that too. You've heard Rosa Marie, you've heard Bridget talk about their experiences here. What's your take, Jeff, on what mechanisms should be in place from the federal and state level going forward?
Yeah, I think at the federal level, things have to be broader, and I don't agree with what Manchin has said. The reality is our children really are our future, and we need to take care of them. We need to help develop them. We need to educate them. And really, the child care providers are the front lines for that. And we also have to remember that when the schools closed down, child care centers stayed open. A lot of our providers, they worked right through the pandemic, and they became the teachers, they became the counselors, they became the therapists, they became the lifeline and support. So at the federal level, we need to do something. At the state level, I agree also with Bridget and Pete that they did a great job rolling out the stabilization money. They made it really quick and accessible for a lot of providers, and I have to say it's been a lifeline. I have had many providers tell me if they did not get that stabilization money, and we personally, our agency, helped process over 600 of those applications, and those applications are still open to the end of November 30th. Without that money, they would have definitely 100% closed. It's a shot in the arm. It's a lifeline. The other thing we have to remember, too, that stabilization money, yes, can be used for your rent. It could be used for salaries, but you could also use it for bonuses and to really help support and help some of the providers get through some difficult.
Oh, we lost Jeff for a second there. We'll see if
sorry.
We can.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you there, Jeff. Yep, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I apologize. But we have to remember, also inside that stabilization money, the local stabilization money, they put in their mental health support. Because people recognize the trauma and that our kids and the trauma that the providers have gone through, that money could be used to help the providers and the families and the children being served as well. So I think the local and the state did a great job, and I think the federal has to be broad.
Let me get some feedback from listeners. On the phone in Canandaigua, this is Paul. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. Let's see if we got Paul. I think I've got Paul punched. Let me try this again.
Here.
There's Paul. Hey, Paul, go ahead.
I am here.
Okay.
Thank you, Evan.
Yep.
One of my comments, I may be off topic, but it was brought up to my attention that about 75% of Pell Grant recipients eventually flunk out of college. And if we use that money for those individuals who would not succeed in college and put that into child care, universal pre-K, that might yield better results than sending someone to college who really isn't capable of finishing college. And I know it's in the millions of dollars. It may not be popular, but I think ultimately it would yield better results than what we're seeing right now.
So you're just looking purely at ROI and saying if we've got to fund something in regards to investing in young people, we can shift from one pot to another here.
We should start younger.
Okay.
Exactly.
Paul, thank you for the phone call. Pete Nabosny, is that a logical shift in funding, or do you want to protect the Pell sort of pot of money and find a different stream here?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really dug into all of the efficacy of the Pell grants in some time, but, you know, I think in general, you know, we should find ways to structure these programs so that people succeed. So if the kind of the failure rate, I guess, is really high, you know, as opposed to pulling away that support for, you know, lowering kids from lower income households who are trying to go to college, I think we should, you know, identify some of those barriers that exist. One actual barrier that exists in New York State for you know, again, typically, you know, moms who are enrolled in college and may need childcare, is that the state, if you're in that situation, you may qualify based on your income for assistance. The state has a rule that in addition to maintaining a good GPA and all of that, you also need to work at least 20 hours a week. And so that's the kind of thing that I think can set someone up for failure when they've, you know, they've got a young child, which is a lot of work. They're enrolled in, you know, community college or a four-year program, and we require that person to work a half-time job in addition to that. So Assemblymember Sarah Clark has a bill that would repeal that. I think that's a good idea. I think there are other things like that we could find more ways to support college students rather than, limiting their access to, again, particularly kids from low-income households' access to college.
We'll come back to the phones in a second. I got a couple of emails. One listener directing me to some comments made by a U.S. Senate candidate in Ohio, and that's J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy, who has said that this has become purely a political issue for Democrats. J.D. Vance has said that the best situation for children is to be primarily raised directly by their parents. And whether that's a mother or father at home and not a child care worker. And so more money for daycare and child care, according to J.D. Vance, puts more kids away from their families. So let me ask our guests about that, and I'll start with Bridget Chumway. What do you think, Bridget?
I just don't think he lives in the real world. I don't know who he is, but he doesn't live in the real world. It often takes two parents to be able to raise their children, afford their mortgage or their rent. And, in some cases, there's only one parent to do it. And then what do we do with the children? I'd like to comment on something Paul said, if it's okay.
Sure.
So Paul mentioned, individuals who may start college and not finish. I think we need to see child care as a potential profession. It's a problem that often we haven't, we look at it differently. And what we're trying to do at Generations is to convince some of our entry-level people that you can go through a career ladder with us. You could go from a teacher assistant to a lead teacher to a senior lead to a classroom coordinator assistant. We will help you do that. We will help you grow. So when you're looking for that first job and it looks like you're going to make more money stocking shelves, you might make a little more money stocking shelves than you might as a teacher assistant with us, but we offer you some longevity and a career ladder. And so maybe for those folks that that college wasn't the right place, but they love working with kids, come check us out. We'll give you a profession. We'll give you a career. And when you get to be a classroom coordinator, you will be making, enough to help your family.
Most places in this industry are hiring right now. Are you hiring right now?
Yes, we are.
I imagine you are. I imagine you are a Generations child care. Rosa Marie Curtis, what do you make of the emailer directing me to J.D. Vance's comments, a U.S. Senate candidate in Ohio, who says that this is the wrong kind of investment for the federal government because it pushes kids farther away from their own parents?
I don't know what context this person is making this statement in, but I personally am raising my two boys in a two-parent household of working parents who still need support. I mean, if the pandemic was not any evidence to that it takes a village to raise one child, then I don't know where else we can go from there. You definitely have to wrap your children around like-minded people who have the same values, same goals for your culture, for your child, and two people cannot do that alone.
Okay. Jeff Peer, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. And the reality is, too, we know over the last year or two that a lot of the children were home with their families, and we've seen a lot more mental health issues come out of that, a lot more development issues come out of that as well, that we are addressing. And again, it's addressing the stabilization dollars to meet those needs. We also have to understand when we send kids to school and we send the kids to child care programs, they're able to ask questions and talk to these kids. And if there's anything going on in the home that any kind of abuse, a lot of times our child care providers are the first line for that. So I would always say it takes a village. And I think parents obviously do a great job, but our parents need a lot of help as well.
Pete Nabosny at the Children's Agenda. I'm going to be surprised if you endorse this idea from J.D. Vance, but go ahead.
Well, so I think I'm not going to be too charitable, I guess. I think the notion that, because my children go to a child care program that I'm not raising them, I think is a bit off base. I think I'm still, a pretty active parent. But I think what he's sort of argued for is that we should have more expanded child tax credits, things like that to families that aren't conditioned on
you know, your kid being in a structured childcare setting of some kind. And I would say that we need to do both, that families need more, you know, we've spoken several times in the show about the child tax credit and its importance for lowering poverty, ensuring more, household financial security, accounting for the fact that kids cost a lot of money outside of all the childcare stuff. But so I think he's sort of framing it as we should do this rather than that. And I think a more comprehensive approach to supporting families with particularly young children is to do both and to offer both, more financial support for all the costs that exist and have assistance helping, those working parents afford the cost of care.
Let me get David and Allison on the phone. David first in Middlesex. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think one important comment that we're missing in this conversation is that we keep talking about centers that exist today. Talk about the subsidies for children. We talk about the potential subsidies for employers. But we also have to think about the expansion of childcare. And my understanding is that there isn't a lot of support from the state to open up new centers. And that's a very large upfront cost. And so we have to think, if childcare providers are struggling today, think about the struggle that it would take to open up a new center.
Bridget, you want to weigh in on that?
It's pretty interesting. There's a crisis in this community for infant toddler care, and I have a project ready to go to expand a center for that type of care. And I contacted Finger Lakes Economic Development Council. They're very nice people, but they basically said there's no money to do something like that. And, I think to myself, well, we give money to build stadiums, and this caller is absolutely correct that the debt burden, Jeff talked about rural communities and needing childcare. The debt burden to open up a center, if it's a center, is extremely expensive. It's not just the building, it's the equipment, it's everything else. And I think it's a great area that if we're really concerned, especially about our rural areas, that, I think there's some money Jeff can speak to this for expansion, but I think it's a very important point.
Okay, Jeff, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so some of the new money that came through the federal government is to look at deserts and opportunities to open up centers where they're needed the most. And again, people have to apply. They'll have to be identified as a desert to make sure that the state identifies it that way. And this is the first time that this has ever happened as well. So the federal government gave the state some money to do that. So entrepreneurs or people like Bridget that have the understanding of what it takes and to open up a center and have the ability to provide that kind of care could apply for some of these funds to do that. But again, these funds are very limited, and I think there has to be more investment from the state and from the federal government for this.
Anything you want to add, Rosa Marie Curtis?
Thank you for having me on the show, and I would just like to echo, the entrepreneurial spirit that was just brought up, that you could apply for those funds. And Marvelous Mind Academy is here to help in any way that we can and support families in this community in Rochester. This is our community, and we're here for you.
All right. We got a few minutes left. I'm going to grab a phone call. I'll get Allison, and then there's a pile of emails. I'll get through as much as we can before the hour is up. David, thank you for that call. This in Rochester, this is Allison. Hi, Allison. Go ahead.
Hi. So as somebody that is a working mother that uses one of the services that are on the call with Rosa Marie, I think that the comment earlier from that governor or whomever in government that said that it should be primarily the mother and father raising the child, it takes a community and a village of people, especially that are like-minded, that are going to help your child. And then we also are losing the mental health component of the amount of stress that puts on the mother primarily, or the parent that is staying home, that having some sort of a bridge care program that Marvelous Minds Academy does offer with 3 hours, and it's not that whole commitment of the week, I know that when I was working in corporate America, it didn't make sense for me to stay there. I was working 4 out of 5 days, and I was paying for childcare majority of what my paycheck was. But then staying home was also really hard on your mental health because it's isolating for the parent that is home. So there's a lot that we all need to consider, especially within childcare and finding good childcare, because we were on wait lists for a center for 6 months for my newborn, and it was hard to find somewhere that is going to provide high quality care that you're okay with walking away from your kid and having them in the arms of somebody else for however long you're going to be gone throughout the day. So
yeah.
I think holding, yeah.
Allison, how old is your child that's at Marvelous Mind?
She is 4 now, and she does not want to leave. So that's the problem. She will go there and won't want to come home. And she's learned so much from the staff there and also the other children, because you learn a lot of skills. Your kids will learn those by going and being around other people besides their immediate family unit. Like, my parents aren't retired. My husband's parents just are retired. And a lot of times, like, they are the ones, the grandparents are the ones raising them, and that just isn't the case anymore, where people's grandparents are around or their families. We live in a different world than we did 40 to 50 years ago.
Yeah,
so.
And I just want to ask you real briefly before I kick it over to our guests here. Allison, you know, you bring up the notion of, you know, the comments from J.D. Vance in Ohio, his desire to see more kids raised primarily by their own parents. You know, Pete Nabosny is right. My bias here lies with where Pete Nabosny was earlier this hour, which is that, you know, I have a 9-year-old son who has been in a number of different settings for daycare, childcare, parental care, et cetera. I am a very active dad, but I'm not with him all the time. And, you know, he's got an army. He's got a tremendous set of advantages and an army of family, friends, and community who helps raise him. And I actually think that makes him a more well-rounded, better kid than if it was just, you know, 2 parents raising him almost, you know, sort of in perpetuity without. I think that the mix of experiences is really valuable for him. And
absolutely.
That's my bias. I endorse what Pete said. And it sounds like you feel that it's not just that you've got bridge care, so you know there's somewhere safe for your kid, but you actually think this is developmentally beneficial, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And then also for my mental health, to be able to take care of myself fully and be able to have that time to have a date night with my partner, to be able to go to a doctor's appointment, to be able to take care of myself fully and be able to spend time with her and be present with her, and to have that resource to be able to have her go somewhere where she's safe and loved and being well taken care of, and then also having myself be well taken care of too, because there's that whole, I can't take care of her if I'm not taking care of me. So.
Well, Allison, I appreciate the phone call, and let me send it over to Rosemarie Curtis, who I suspect also appreciates that call. Go ahead, Rosemarie.
I wholly appreciate this call, and I am going to be super transparent with all the guests, you, the listener, and Allison. I am in tears. Okay, I am an entrepreneur, a mom who is struggling, who followed her passion to answer this call, and to hear firsthand from a parent in our program is just so heartwarming. And thank you, Allison. I appreciate you so much.
Bridget Shumway, what is your mindset on the value of a diverse set of experiences for a child? And where does that factor in for you and what you're trying to do with Generations? I mean, you had Allison saying there are times where her daughter doesn't even want to leave Marvelous Mind. You know you've done something special when a child who is always going to feel comfortable with their parents also feels like there's a sense of family with you.
Yeah, it is a wonderful thing. It was a beautiful call, Allison. I really enjoyed listening to it. There isn't anything better than when you see children running to the caregivers and the teachers in your building, and they are family. You know, they can start out with you as an infant, and they can stay with you until they're 10 years old. And it is a great feeling to know that you've supported the families in the community and that you make a difference in the life of a child.
Well, real quick before we lose the hour, are you optimistic that you'll be able to fill any staffing position soon? I mean, is there anything that you can do now that gives you some hope that you're going to get people on staff?
Oh, I wish I could say I'm really optimistic. We have a new center at Clinton Square that just opened 2 days ago. High demand for infant and toddler care, and we're doing everything. We're spending a ton of money on Indeed. The stabilization grants, as Jeff mentioned, really couldn't have come at a better time to help us with bonuses to keep our staff and hopefully to bring new staff on.
Okay. Jeff Peer is the executive director of the Child Care Council. Let me give you 30 seconds. What's the most immediate set of need that can get done next year to start solving this crisis?
Well, number one, we have to really focus on the staffing. And one thing I want to do is just say we need to get businesses more involved, too. Mm-hmm. We could get the community and the businesses involved and invest in child care benefits for their employees. That could help with the payment. And again, if we could make sure that families feel comfortable with what they're paying for child care, then the centers will have the revenue they need to pay their staff more and to provide incentives as well. So something I will look forward to is working with the business community to assure that maybe we're looking at some benefit packages and how we could do that to support the families in the community.
Okay. Rosemarie Curtis, 20 seconds. Are you an optimist that you'll be able to continue doing what you need to do at Marvelous Mind?
Highly optimistic, yes, primarily because we started in the pandemic full time. And so having this, you know, tumultuous experience as our foundation, I don't know what will cause us to not be optimistic. We're still standing. So.
And Pete Nabosny at the Children's Agenda, Dr. David Topa says the president's proposal doesn't funnel money to private industries to manage jails, build roadways, and build warplanes. It invests in kids. And so David Topa says he's endorsing what Pete Nabosny says about where the federal sort of investment's going to go. But we'll be monitoring that. Pete, I hope you'll come back and talk to us soon about that. A lot afoot on the federal and state side of this. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you. Whenever you want.
Pete Nabosny, Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda. Jeff Peer at the Child Care Council. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
You'll find Rosemarie Curtis at Marvelous Mind Academy. Thank you, Rosemarie.
Thank you.
And Bridget Shumway of Generations Childcare. Good luck to you. I know it's hard, important work. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Megan Mack, producing and engineering. Julie Williams joining us today. And the whole team here saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.